You know, there's something about shipwrecks that I find fascinating, and I think a lot of other people do as well, and certainly our guest does today. He's written a number of books about them, and we'll talk about his latest. Wisconsin author Michael Schumacher is with us today. He has published three previous books about Great Lakes shipwrecks: The Mighty Fitz, about the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald; The Wreck of the Carl D, about the loss of the Carl D Bradley; and November's Fury, an account of the storm of 1913, the deadliest in Great Lakes history. His latest is Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell, and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. Quite a story. The sinking happened in 1966, so a ways back. But maybe shipwrecks intrigue you. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Miller Show. Michael Schumacher, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I enjoy these talks.
It's always fun to have you on. And you really are fascinated with shipwrecks. How did that occur?
It started really with my fascination with the Great Lakes. I was brought up in Milwaukee, and my parents used to joke about how, as a young boy, I used to beg them to take me to the lake. I don't know why that is. To this day, I don't know why that is. But to this day, I go down to Lake Michigan every day, and I will sit, you know, in a parking space and just kind of look out over the water. It's something I've been drawn to for as long as I can remember. And so that the extension of interest in shipwrecks, and I might add, like, lighthouses and shipwreck museums and so forth, is sort of a natural extension of that. The stories are really pretty amazing to me. And I find that a lot of readers like me in the respect that they're fascinated by these also.
Has writing these books discouraged you from going out on the lakes?
Not at all. You know, it's real funny. When I talk to these people, and I've got over the years, I don't know how many people I've interviewed, who sailed, and they all have essentially the same take, and that is, if you don't feel safe on the lake in your boat, I don't know what we're going to do with you, because you know, that was just their take. It's very, very safe. And what happened in the cases of the three shipwrecks that I handled individually, as well as all the other ones on the lakes, as a general rule, is that things occurred, and by that I mean it's usually never one thing that brings down a boat. It's usually a combination of things. And things occurred that should not have occurred. One of the people I interviewed, I remember, said, well, you know, you don't get in your car and go to the supermarket to pick up a few items and think, gee, I'm going to be killed on my way to the supermarket today. You know, someone's going to hit me, and that's going to be that. It's very similar with the boats on the lake. These sailors really believe, sometimes to their detriment, too, I might add, when you talk to some of these people, and they just go, no, it could never happen to me. That I'm sure that's how it feels, you know, or felt for the people that are in these boats that I've written about.
Well, I think this the book you written about this particular ship is set apart from your other books, I think, because it focuses a bit on the. The person who survived it. That doesn't always happen.
No, it doesn't. And I've always thought that my books had sort of a theme to them. Like, the Edmund Fitzgerald was a mystery. No one knows why that boat sank. And so there's been a lot of discussion about it, a lot of work done about it. When I was researching it, I went out to the Coast Guard Center in Washington, D.C. and looked at their big vault that they have on the Edmund Fitzgerald. So that's that. The Carl Bradley, the theme I thought was, this was a book about a town, Rogers City, Michigan, where the overwhelming percentage of people, it was like 20, I'd have to look this up to be sure, but it was like 28 of the people on that boat were from Rogers City, Michigan, this little tiny city in Michigan, or towns around it. And so when that boat sank, it created a tremendous drama when people were looking for survivors and so forth. And they found two did survive. And so it was about this little town and how they you know, how it reacted to all this.
Mm-hmm.
The storm about the 1913 storm is just that. It's a book about an incredible storm. This one, I see, is being about a survivor, about Dennis Hale. The circumstances between the reasons the boats broke in half and sank are very similar between the Carl Bradley and the Daniel Morrell. But his story as the sole survivor of this wreck and being out on the water for all of those hours, better than a day and a half, he was out on the water in very late November, November 29th and 30th, in the middle of a horrible storm. Here he was wearing nothing but his boxer shorts and a pea coat and, you know, facing, you know, conditions that should have killed him. A hypothermia probably should have set in before he was found. But somehow, miraculously, he survived, and this is his story.
Yeah, it's really sad. And in fact, weren't there two others that kind of got off the boat or were in sight of him at some point who did die?
Right. There were actually three. There were two that died almost overnight. I mean, the boat went down at like 2 o'clock in the morning, if I remember right, somewhere in that neighborhood. And they were dead by sunup. There was one other guy who survived with him, and he hung in there the whole day, and he died around 4:30 in the afternoon, somewhere in that neighborhood. And then Dennis was alone. And his story was so strange to me, too, is that it tells you something about what the elements do to you. His raft blew up onto the rocks within very, very short walking distance of the shore. By walking distance, the water was only about knee-deep. But he was too weak to even get up off the raft at that point and walk to shore. There was a house nearby, and he could see the lights on in the house and everything. He shouted for help, but nobody could hear him because of the noise of the waves and everything else. And so he sat there on that boat, you know, for overnight and then all through the next day. So it was, you know, it's quite the story.
It's amazing. Dennis in Green Bay has a question. Dennis, hi. Sure. Thanks for calling.
Hi. As I recall reading this story, they kind of figured this gentleman survived because he was encased in ice, which helped him not develop hypothermia. Is that true?
Well, one of the theories, I actually spoke to the physician who treated him when they brought him in eventually. And he thought the fact that Dennis was a little overweight, that he had extra, you know, extra protection. The ice, I've heard that theory. I don't know how true it is. In other words, anything that cools your body temperature is not good for you. When he tried to eat ice because he was so thirsty, that gave him the first of a series of very, very important hallucinations. Where he saw an old man standing on his raft telling him, do not eat the ice. If you eat this ice, you will lower your body temperature and you'll die, which is really an astonishing hallucination, since Dennis had no idea about any of this prior to it. And the doctor thought those hallucinations may have helped save him, where he gave him, you know, the mental fortitude, so to speak, to survive excruciatingly difficult and painful conditions. So who knows? I mean, theories abound on some of this stuff. And I guess that's one of the things that people like about reading these books, is because they get involved in some of this themselves. You know, well, the Fitzgerald, this happened with the Fitzgerald, or this happened with the Carl Bradley. I think it's one of the things that attracts people to this, is they kind of get their own involvement in the theories for what sank the ship, and in this case, what let that guy survive.
Yeah, Dennis, thanks. I want to give Mark and Sister Bay a chance. Mark, hello.
Yeah, how you doing? Good. I just want to say I had a cousin that went down on the Edmund Fitzgerald, Oliver J. Buck Champeau. He was the assistant engineer. And yeah, I remember at the time it was a bit of a shock. I didn't really know the man. When I grew up in Sister Bay, a friend of mine whose father had a newspaper in the Chicago Tribune, and he told me about it, and I had to research it, and I found out, sure enough, you know, this was a, you know, a cousin from the family. And then I was also going to ask you, are you aware of the four wrecks on top of each other off of, I think it's Pilot Island?
No, I'm not, actually. I know of some that have come to settle like that elsewhere, but not four of them. That's pretty amazing. I'm not aware of that at all.
Yeah, I think it's four. Anyways, there's a informational marker up by the ferry dock that talks about them.
Ferry dock at where again?
The ferry dock in Northport.
Oh, in Northport. Okay.
Yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about was that there's 10,000 shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, and that they found they've got 6,000 that were documented, and the other 4,000 are still undiscovered.
Still out there somewhere.
When I was writing the book about the 13th storm, the November's Fury, I had finished the book. I had turned it in. It had been edited and set to type.
And you know what? I'm gonna hold you right there, and you're gonna divulge what happened right after we take a look at the news. Stay with us, Sir Michael. We'll be right back after this look at the news. Well, on November 26th of 1966, the Great Lakes freighter Daniel J. Morrell went down in very heavy seas on Lake Huron. Only one man survived, and we've been hearing about his story of survival and about the circumstances of the sinking with Wisconsin author Michael Shoemaker. He has published three previous books about the Great Lakes shipwrecks. And great to have him talk with us about his latest. It's called Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. Maybe you have a question about shipwrecks. Any shipwrecks on the Great Lakes affected your life? I hope you'll call in 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Michael, as we were going up to the news time, someone called about shipwrecks and the number that had been found and not yet been found, and you were telling a story about finishing a book. So complete that story.
Well, it was just very strange because the whole book had been finished. It was ready to go.
And it was about which one again?
This was about the 1913 storm, November's Fury. And as we were getting ready to go, they found one of the boats that had been missing all these years. They located one of the big ones, the Smith. And so I had to rewrite kind of the ending of the book. And I had to interview the people that found the boat and all of this. And then it gave it a whole different spin for me because they are still finding only a couple missing yet from that storm. People go, well, how come it's taken so long to find these boats? Well, we have to keep in mind, too, the technology wasn't there to even look for them, you know, not to mention dive them. They didn't have, you know, the different kind of scanning equipment and so forth that they have where they could find them. So over many, many years, they just were down there where they went down and people suspected they went in this area. The Smith was found because of a computer mapping program that had been set up to find it. So many things have changed, and it was just very strange to all of a sudden, you know, you think you're all done. You're kind of breathing a sigh of relief that you finished the book and everything, and, well, not necessarily. And so, you know, I was put back on the case. So that was kind of an interesting turn of events. But what that caller said before is very true. A person could spend his or her entire life writing just about Great Lakes shipwrecks because each one of these shipwrecks is an interesting story unto itself. Prior to doing all of this work, I wrote the narratives to 25 little documentaries about Great Lakes shipwrecks and lighthouses. And this is what I found out. They're just, if you go up by the Isle Royal in Lake Superior, there are tons of them just right around that island. And so, you could do a whole series of books just on those boats that went down and so on. So it's kind of fascinating to me.
And I have Jill actually posted a little video up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. It's right under the posting we have of your book of the Daniel J. Morrell, somebody diving on it right now, and what it looks like right now under the water. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool video. As you're listening to Michael and I talk today, you might want to click on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and take a look at us. The Dennis Hale, the guy that survived, and he had hallucination. He had more than one hallucination, did he?
Yes, he did. Yes. It was so interesting to me to hear that doctor say how important those were. It just gave him, they were all sort of positive, or at least hopeful. One of the hallucinations was of he was being lifted off of the raft, that he was lifted into the sky and moved at a very high rate of speed to this sort of other land. You know, you can call it nirvana, you can call it heaven, you can call it anything. And on that land, he was greeted by an old man who asked him some questions before he allowed him to enter. And when he entered, the bow section of the Morrell was in the distance. And he went, and some of his crewmates were there, and they were, of course, thrilled to see him. And while they were talking, the back, the stern portion of the Morrell was seen in the distance. It came forward and forward, and it linked up with the bow until the Morrell was like it had been. And he had this wonderful experience of seeing his dead crewmates. And then all of a sudden, one of them from the engine room said to him, "But Dennis, you don't belong here. You can't be here. Your time on Earth is not over yet." And he was, pulled away. And before he knew it, he was back on the raft and suffering and so forth all over again. So, but this was something for him, because he had felt so badly about losing these friends of him. Yes, that crew was like family to him. He had a unique situation where he really didn't have any feel of family. These people became his family, and when he lost them, it was a tremendous loss.
Yeah, it was. And he was reluctant, if I'm not mistaken, to talk about those hallucinations.
Right.
Because he was, of course, the press and, the media sort of descended on him and created, even in a way, created even more problems for him.
Yeah, first of all, we're not used to being, most of us anyway, aren't used to being interviewed. Know when I've conducted my own interviews, sometimes I even, because I tape the interviews, and I'll even hide the tape recorder where they can't see it, because they'll be very, very aware of the fact that it's there.
Yeah.
And, they'll be talking into it, or they're very careful about what they say and so on and so forth. In Dennis's case, he'd never had any such experience. And all of a sudden, here he is at the white-hot center of this story that is fascinating people literally from coast to coast, but certainly around the Great Lakes states, people were flooding in trying to get him. At one point, they actually stashed him in the maternity ward of the hospital so nobody could get anywhere near him. Because it was in this little tiny hospital, not that many rooms and beds, and the crush of interest on this was unbelievable. And, then he meets this priest, and Dennis was a religious man. He was a Catholic, and he was very religious. And the priest told him, "Well, don't say anything about those hallucinations, for God's sake. People will think you're crazy." And it stunned him. He thought of all the people on Earth that would understand his situation, it would be this priest. Yeah. And so he held it inside, and it created a sort of a bitterness that took him many years to overcome.
Did you have a chance to speak with him?
Oh, yes. I met Dennis for the first time up in Rogers City for the 50th anniversary of the sinking of the Carl Bradley. They have a bell ringing service, and anybody that's ever seen that will know how solemn and moving those are, where they ring a bell for everyone who perished on board that boat. Then they ring it one extra time for all the boats that went down to the Great Lakes. Dennis was invited to be there to ring a bell for the captain of the Carl Bradley. And so we were, you know, in the same place. This is little, it was a high school, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there, and we sat and talked. I mean, I'm not going to say forever, but for quite a while. And then, you know, I talked to him. I was not planning on writing this book at that time. I had no idea I was going to. But we talked about the Morrell because I was fascinated. Here, I've got the survivor right here with me. And then later on, of course, when I decided that I wanted to write this book, I spoke to him again. And he was always very forthcoming about this. Once he decided that he... It had a cleansing effect, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm. on him, just talking about this. And so he, you know, he was very forthcoming about everything that happened to him. And I found him to be quite a nice guy.
Yeah, I think he just died about a year ago only.
Yes. I wish he'd been around to see this book come out.
Yeah.
It's one of those sad stories where that happened one other time for me where I was editing a book of letters between Allen Ginsberg, the poet, and his father. And we dedicated the book to Allen's brother, Eugene. And Gene died like a month before the book came out.
Oh.
And I remember, because we didn't tell him it was dedicated to him. It was supposed to be a surprise. And I remember his widow saying to us, she kind of laughed, says, I guess that just tells you, you know, and because I forget how old he was. He was 80 or something. So I guess that goes to show you, you don't surprise somebody at that age.
Well, the story, I mean, you really write this well. I'm particularly taken by the part where the sinking of the boat and the time right. that he's spent on the water. And imagining those waves and that cold mm-hmm. is just... almost unbelievable that anybody could survive it. So
but he was talking about how they would be huddled on it. It was a little different than the Carl Bradley, the guys that were on. There were four people got on a life raft with the Bradley as well. They didn't, only two of them made it. But when a wave came by, it just throw everybody back into the water and the raft would go flying, et cetera, et cetera. In this case, in the Morrell's case, they went through the waves.
Yeah.
And Dennis talked about how these guys would scream and scream. It was torturous. Every single wave was just unbelievably difficult. It was incredibly cold. You know, you were in there. You couldn't breathe while you were passing through these waves. And he said it was just, you got to the point where these guys just didn't know if they wanted to go on.
Yeah. Yeah, and some had to give up. Gary in Boscobel has something for us. Hi, sure. Gary.
Thank you, Larry. I wanted to ask your guess about, I'd heard a year or so ago a rumor that researchers had found the Griffin.
Yes, I've heard that too.
Is there any other information on that?
Nothing has been confirmed because the Griffin has been found I don't know how many times over the years. It's the very first shipwreck, I should say, for you. Listeners benefit. The first really well-known Great Lakes shipwreck. It disappeared in the middle of a storm, and I forget what year it was. It was a long, long time, 1600s. And it had a very unique, it had a griffin carving at the bow of the boat, you know, like a masthead. And people would know if they saw that they had the griffin. And so, but there's also the chance that after all these years that it would have just sort of decomposed. But they find these very old shipwrecks, and they are hoping to find that one because that's sort of the one of the holy grails, if you want to call it that, of the Great Lakes. And nobody knows where it went down. That's another thing. They have a fairly good idea of where it went down, given the nature of the storm that took it down. But they don't know anything, and this, you find out, finding a single wreck, even if you're pretty sure of where it is, you're almost positive, is a very, very detailed and difficult process on those lakes.
Let's turn to Dave in Baraboo next. Hi, Dave. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I don't know. Maybe the Bradley's the wreck I'm thinking of, but there was a book put out by the UW Press probably, I know, 20 years ago. It was called Fire and Ice. Was that the Bradley?
That was the Bradley.
And that
was written by a guy who was the book review editor of the Milwaukee Journals, Bob Wells. And I owe a lot of my career to Bob. He was a very, very good man, and it was an excellent book.
The Bradley went down in 57, didn't it?
58.
Okay, and I thought what I remember reading was that because those that freezing water in November, the ice and all that, mm-hmm. They came up with the Gumby suit, the survival suit, so I'm surprised that by the time the Morrell, which was almost 10 years later, those guys didn't have the survival suits, or when did those come about?
No. Well, it's... I don't want to let my cynicism show here, but the problem with these wrecks is that everybody gets very determined after a wreck. We're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to make it safe. And then when they find out how expensive it is and so forth, it gets passed along. You know, and the Fitzgerald is a perfect example. It was something, you know, that was very modern, very big, very, very well equipped with safety equipment that did not have those either. There are the enclosed life rafts now where you can get out of the elements. You're inside, you know, and they talk about getting these things, but they never quite happen. Something always does happen. For example, in the case of the Daniel J. Morrell, it lost its radio when the boat was splitting in half. It happened so quickly that they lost all their electricity at the front end of the boat where all the radio equipment was, so they could not send out an SOS. That was one of the reasons Dennis Hale was on the water as long as he was, you know, nobody knew the boat had sunk, let alone that anybody was out there. And so after the Coast Guard hearings and everything, they made some decrees that have to be followed about having battery-operated equipment on board to have it set up so this could never happen again. And that's usually what happens. But the big features, the safety features, are always the ones that seem to get neglected. And part of it is that there's a certain, it's almost arrogance that this won't happen to us. We're too good a boat. I mean, you can talk to those big thousand-footers, the captains of those big thousand-footers out there, and I have, and they'll say, oh, this will never sink. Well, don't you bet on it.
Yeah,
that's, I remember the foreword had in it, the quote, it isn't that the sea is inherently dangerous, she's just unforgiving of mistakes.
That's right.
And you're out there, I was on a scientific cruise, and the crew was not very, they didn't keep it ship shape, and we hit a storm, this was off Bermuda, and we took like a 45 degree roll, and they had an unsecured diesel head on a shelf. And it ended
that thing went flying.
Yeah. It fell and landed on a generator. It's all we had with the bow thrusters, and there were 50-foot waves. They said if it hadn't hit the generator, it probably would have punched a hole in the hull.
Yeah.
We hadn't been shown how to use the survival suits yet.
No.
Right. Yeah, this is the way it works.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sad, but it's true.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Dave, for calling. I really appreciate your call on that story. That man, there's a lot of them. And as a matter of fact, I'm just looking here on one of my computer screens. John emailed to say there's a search going on right now. This is for a fishing party. Two men and a 9-year-old boy. They're missing off Jacobsville, Michigan lighthouse on Lake Superior. So that it keeps going on. Bradley emailed to ask where he could find records of ship rosters.
Of ship good luck. That's my reaction to that. is that the problem was back in those days, they did not. It got better and better over time. With the book I wrote on the 1913 storm, they had almost nothing. You know, the lists were not accurate either. What would happen is you'd have a boat that enlisted 30 crew members. Sometimes they had them by name, sometimes not. But they'd have, this is what we have. Well, those crew members would bring some of their spouses or this or that on board, too. So the number of people on board would bulge, and the boat would go down. You had no idea how many people were on this boat. And, you know, that was that's the case all the way through. The Edmund Fitzgerald had very, very nicely appointed quarters for visitors and guests. The corporate guests, all sorts of people would get on there, and they would not be included in the list. So the rosters, that's a very, very good question, and unfortunately, there is no answer to it. They don't exist, these lists.
Oh, that's too bad. And even in Dennis Hale's, didn't he actually miss and have to race ahead or something to get another port?
Dennis Hale, you know, with all due respect, because like I said, I really like this guy, he was kind of a screw-up. he missed the boat on a couple of occasions. And on this one, it was very, very important. He and a buddy had jumped off the Morrell and gone home to visit family nearby with the idea that we're going to get back in time and we'll get back on board and we'll take off. Well, they were loading the Morrell, and anybody that's watched one of these things get loaded knows how long a period of time that takes. It was not a bad guess on Dennis's part, but it was a bad one in respect that when he got back with his friend, they saw the boat, the Morrell, literally at the breakwater. It was leaving. And so they got a hold of the Coast Guard, who got a hold of Captain Crawley of the Morrell, who said, meet us up here at this port in Canada. And then they beat tracks up there to catch the boat. And you know, don't think Dennis didn't appreciate the irony of that. After all that work to get back on the boat, and then it sinks.
Oh, man.
But he was looking at, and again, this is 1966. It would have been, like, I think, if I remember, like, somewhere in the neighborhood of $5,000 to $6,000 he would have lost if he had not gotten on that boat. Because you got all your end-of-the-season pay and a number of bonuses for that last trip of the season. And it's also ironic in a respect that the Morrell wasn't even supposed to be out there.
Yeah.
They'd done their last trip. And then a boat broke down, and so they sent the Morrell and its sister ship, the Townsend, out to get one last load of iron ore. And
that's what did them in. Oh, yeah. Man.
It's really, this is how, to me, that's how these stories are so interesting, is that there's always the story behind the story. The guy that got off the boat, he was sick. He had pneumonia, he's in the hospital, and he survived only because he was in the hospital.
Yeah. I tell you what, Michael, you've got a fascinating book here, and I want to thank you so much. We're out of time, but I appreciate you being with us today. We'll look forward to a next visit from you.
Thanks. I look forward to it, too. It's always fun.
Michael Schumacher is author of Torn in Two, The Sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell and One Man's Survival on the Open Sea. Quite a book to read. Well, thank you so much. Thanks to him, and thank you for listening. P.J. Leash comes by tomorrow to talk about caterpillars and fall invasive insects. Thank you for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.